everyone. This is Meredith Griffin.
And Lou Zand. And welcome to the first episode of season 7.
Woo!
Can you believe we're in season 7, Mer?
Lucky number.
Right. And I don't know. I swear it would be impossible to kick off a new season any better with any better guest than who we have today. I'm fired up.
Yep, as am I. And, you know, we got to end season 6 with Jason Wise, the director, producer, founder of the SOM movies, SOM TV. And we kind of did a little teaser at the very short little teaser at the end of season 6. So for our listeners, if you want to hear kind of how Jason got involved with the SOM movies, go back and listen to our teaser that we did at the end of the summer. But today we're going to check in with Jason and see what he's been up to this summer, because we know he's been busy with new projects, a new movie that came out. And what's going on, Jason? How's summer been?
It's good. Congrats on a 7th season. You guys are like MASH or something, or Friends. I'm trying to think like what shows go that long. Congrats. I'm good. You know, it's a weird question. People ask like, what are you doing? And when you run SOM TV and you run, you know, have all the podcasts and stuff that we do, it's like, I don't know how to answer that, because it is so, it's a lot going on, but always good stuff. I mean, we released a feature film. I have 3 in production, 2 in post, 1 finishing filming, features. And then, geez, we have in October, I have a shorter documentary, so like a 30-minute coming. I have, some big announcements I wish to God I could talk about right now, but I'm not allowed to because I'll get in trouble. But there's a lot of good stuff. I mean, honestly,
hey, we won't tell anybody, Jason.
That's good. It's just us.
Just us. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there is some juicy stuff I can talk about, so it's good. I mean, you know, it just depends on how much patience you all have for hearing me ramble. It's really
got plenty.
We've got all day, nowhere to be. So
good. Yeah, I'm sure that's the case. No, yeah, it's good. It's good.
Yeah, so let's kick it off talking a little bit about The Whole Animal, because when we talked to you at the end of summer, it hadn't been released yet.
That's right.
You were, I think, getting ready to head out for a release party and doing that. So I think you were anticipating what the audience response was. So give us a little bit about that. And maybe for those of our, you know, our listeners who may not know what The Whole Animal is, tell them what it's about.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the big things when we launched SOM TV, and also basically my whole entire film career, was getting food is a very different thing than wine. And, you know, a lot of people who have, they ask me, how the heck do you make wine stuff interesting and whatever else? But I've always wanted to do food content. Food is one of these things that is both harder and somewhat easier in a couple different realms. And so The Whole Animal is a feature film we worked on for many, many, many years. It came about after SOM 1 as an idea that, well, there's this profession. Now, first, I want to be clear. The film is about eating meat. The film is about the history of and the culture of using the entire animal to make dishes that are regionally really important, have a lot to do with culture. And in a lot of cases, a lot of these dishes that were like, quote unquote, peasant food are now in like 3-star Michelin restaurants, and these big chefs get this credit for stuff that was created in like mountain towns in Italy. And it was really out of a desire to not waste anything because you didn't have any money. And by doing that, they created some of the world's great dishes. And so we filmed in 9 countries for this film, 7 or 8 countries. I don't even remember, my head's spinning. But this was our big like walk into food on SOM TV. So a massive original film that kind of starts in this, starts in the mountains of Italy and goes all over the place, all the way to Argentina, Italy, France, Germany, the United States. And it's really just a look at the respect to the animal, the respect to the people doing this. And I sort of looked at the profession of the butcher, which that word is so maligned and people don't know what that job does, and how that profession is at the very center of a wheel that the spokes go out to farmers and ranchers and the consumer. And it's a really important, we wanted people to know what that profession meant. And so after we did something about sommeliers with SOM 1, the thought was, what other professions are important from a place that you don't sort of think of them as having the influencer, you know? And so that, and a film I released at the beginning of COVID, sadly, called The Delicacy, about fishermen, sea urchin divers. So that and The Whole Animal were sort of our first jumps. And since then, we've released our big flagship show, which is called Pairings, about food and wine pairing. And it's like sort of our, for lack of a better comp, sort of our chef's table kind of a show. And so we're getting deep into the food space, and Whole Animal was the beginning of that.
Yeah, I thought you guys did a great job. And I think one of the things, because it really enlightened, I watched it with David, is the idea of a butcher and how they're really, you don't find butcher shops anymore. Usually you go to your grocery store and it's just what's packaged there, and the loss of that, I think, telling that story. So how has it been received by the audience? Have you found, you know, it accomplished? Did you have like a goal with putting the movie out?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so we did a big premiere in Chicago at the Historic Music Box Theater, which is one of the country's greatest, you know, real old, beautiful, huge places. And it was great. We had a Michelin star chef cooking, grilling steak and all sorts of food there. And it couldn't have gone better. It was fantastic. And so the response has been great. I will say there's this really interesting thing with the, maybe, I don't know how old I am at this point, but maybe two generations below me, where the tracing of where stuff comes from, they really actually do care. And we've been saying this now for like a generation or two, that people want to know where their food comes from. But, you know, if you are a butcher and you're buying a whole animal and you have to make it into many different cuts of steaks and all the different things that you would make it, even a chicken, you don't throw away anything. And there is this very interesting thing with the younger generation that there is, like, they don't want waste. They care a lot about carbon footprint. And I think the thing that surprised me was how environmentally focused this film has been received. That's something that's really about, because I think, I don't want to get too deep into this, but meat gets kind of a bad rap as being something that's, you know, bad for the environment or whatever else. But really, it's there's a process people are forgetting that it's not, you know, it's not that. It's that people are eating the wrong stuff. They're eating too much of it. They're doing X. They're doing Y. And that's across anything. And when you have a butcher, that profession, they know where the stuff came from. They know, they talk to the rancher. There's a relationship there, and there's a pipeline missing. And this is like a connection with wine that's kind of magical. As you look at a wine bottle, and if you know how to read the language, you know it came from this place, you know who made it, there's a story there if you're willing to listen. And that's kind of been really lost with food, when prior generations, they didn't go in and say, I'm buying a ribeye. They would go in and say, I'm not sure what I'm buying, I'd like to cook X, what do you have? And they would say, well, for look what we have for this price, have you thought about doing a stew or this or that? And that's like gone now.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea is, when you go into one of these restaurants and you're like amazed by something like shepherd's pie, and you're like, what a cool hip thing, and you pay $42 for a shepherd's pie, that was supposed to be like what people ate
The
end of a hard day's work, you know. So if you have a Guinness and a shepherd's pie, that was supposed to be easy, simple food that was made with what you could. And now it's like hip to eat, like, I don't know, you know, it's kind of one of these, I sound like an old man now, but that's the idea.
No, I think it's really valuable.
It's so true. You know, don't watch this movie if you're hungry, number one. And number two, it's so convicting, Jason. You know, I got it. I got it right off the bat. Just like, what are we doing here? And I've had so much fun now talking with my friends and saying, look, when we get together to barbecue this weekend, we got to try this, you know, and we're trying some new cuts. And, you know, the fact is that kind of hit home with me is, you know, we grew up in the grocery store, in the supermarket, excuse me. When they show that picture, I mean, that was my mom shopping, and we only buy a T-bone or chicken breasts or chicken thighs. You know, that's the or chicken wings. And it was just so convicting and so cool.
Well, I mean, you know, with a food film, you're trying not to look at all this stuff, is you want a respect on the profession, on, in this case, the animal, but you also don't want to make people feel guilty. It's not, you know, you can't say to somebody like, you're a bad person because you don't know how to do this. That's not the point. The point is, culture and history is wrapped up in this. And we're going to do another one of these. This one was mostly focused on Europe. We're going to do another one that gets into the history of barbecue and a lot of Polynesian stuff and a lot of stuff from some West Africa and Jamaica, and things that are just mind blowing, because there was no way to make this film about everything. We had to sort of look at it in three parts. And so there's a plan with how to go forward with this and how it really, you know, honestly, look, if you have people over for dinner, it's a hell of a lot more exciting to talk about the food and what you're eating, what you're drinking, than it is about politics. We all know this. So
yeah,
cook something interesting.
Absolutely. You have something
to talk about.
Yeah. In filming this movie, was there anything that you learned that you didn't know before that was really like, wow, I had no idea? Was there any like big takeaway for you?
Yeah, so much. Yeah, honestly, that's a question that is so much. I think the main thing is that I learned that it's not that hard, or at least it's not that difficult to find and do this stuff. You know, if you're trying to find, and by the way, this transcends meat. I mean, if you're a totally plant-based person, it's really easy to fall into. You eat the same five or six things, you get them from the same five or six places. And I think when it comes to any of this, what I learned is we're buying food for too far in advance, really is, I think, the big thing, or at least I was. You know, you're always like, what am I eating? It's all frozen, which is fine. And you have kids. I mean, it's, you know, I understand how that goes. But the element of buying something on a Sunday you're going to eat Tuesday from a vegetable, a meat, or whatever, it sort of shrinks your world and makes it feel like that person you got it from, you can go back Sunday. And there's this element of like, you don't have to buy everything at the grocery store at one time. And it's a very strange thing to get into that mentality, because the first little week or two you try to do that, it's kind of stressful. But then once you get into the routine, I'm telling you, I start looking forward to finding out, I've never heard of this squash at the farmer's market. And I don't mean to be like that guy, but it's cheaper. It is literally cheaper. I mean, like, you go to the, not everybody has a farmer's market, but what I learned was buying for, you know, a more closer period of time yields much more interesting. It got me back in the kitchen, frankly. I mean, it got me back cooking, which, you know, I haven't been able to do. So it really, also I learned that, you know, I absolutely miss Europe so much. So also some of the simplest food, and this is like sounds so easy, is the best. So like, you know, when you go to Italy or you go to France or you go to parts of the Southern United States or you go to the stuff that didn't take much, you know, and it was just, here's what we had. It was right. It was in season is mind blowing. And it's like, I feel like our food has lost its flavor because we're trying to have the wrong food at the right time of year, Yes. And I know a lot of chefs beat this drum, but I mean, in practice, traveling around the world making this film blows me away with how incredible food can be if you just bend to the seasonality of it. Not from a cliche, not from like a hip standpoint, but just how much better it can taste. So
just real true of what something tastes like. I always say that. And where you get it from, it even goes back to what you were talking about, not just the farmer where your meat from comes from, but the vegetables. If I wish I could grow my own vegetables. I'm not quite that savvy yet. I'm working on it. But to go to the farmer's market and get the tomatoes in season versus going to the grocery store is a totally different thing. And I'm not going to buy tomatoes in winter because it's not when they're the best where I live. And I think when you, I have a friend who doesn't like tomatoes, and then she came to visit me in Sonoma and she had them and she went, oh, wow, that tastes really good. And I was like, that's what a tomato is supposed to taste like.
Yeah. Oh, don't even get me started if you have one in like Greece or Italy. Yeah, oh, my God. Yeah. It's like incredible stuff. Yeah. And I know this is a wine podcast, but this provincial conversation about like kind of where stuff comes from and that it, I don't love the word terroir. It's totally misused, but this is what the definition is. You know, something is supposed to taste kind of where it's from, whether it's wine or tomatoes or oysters or whatever it is. And so, you know, frankly, that's the interesting part about this and why I, no matter how much I say to myself in the darkest moments, all right, that's it. No more wine, no more food films. I need a break. I come across something where it's like something where, you know, you get a story that's linked to something that you consume. And I'm like, that's it. I got to do it again. You know, it's this constant, wonderful cycle, honestly.
You talk a lot about finding the story, and wine and food both offer an opportunity to tell a story where it came from. And then what other parallels do you see between the wine and the, you know, your Saw movies and the whole animal movie that you did? Were there other parallels? I know you hinted to a couple earlier, but.
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, I think it all starts with the number one thing I'm obsessed with are people who are obsessed. And I think that, like, when you look at the sommelier profession or the best of it, and I don't mean the, like, here's my cool bottle on Instagram. I mean, like, I'm actually know I'm a part of the service industry. I want to serve others. I want to be somebody who delivers insider knowledge and gives people things I didn't know existed. That is no different than a real chef. I'm not talking about somebody who's like, hey, put me on a reality show. I'm talking about somebody who's like, I want to be in a kitchen. I want to be creating. I want to see the expression on somebody's face when they try this thing. You know, like, for instance, like, there's, you know, we talk about New Orleans, you know, Chef Meg over at Commander's Palace, who's a dear friend of mine. She does not want to be on TV. She wants to be in the kitchen, busting her butt, cooking. And if you look at that, and you look at that person going, I am in the service industry, I want to serve. And then you look at the sommelier, and you get this like, kind of like, that is almost going away. Everybody thinks these jobs are not a career. And it's really, it's kind of, it's sad, but it's also a really great opportunity for the people who actually want to do it. And you see a lot of amazing people stepping into these roles that a lot of people think they're stepping stones. And I'll be honest with you, that's recent, that to be a great server or a great bartender or a great sommelier or a great chef or whatever else, that was what people trained for years to become. And now it's kind of swung. So I look at it as, like, when I find these obsessive people, like we did in Somme, or like the chefs in The Whole Animal or in Pairings, I go gaga over it, because I just love when people go, I'm not trying to be somebody else. I'm trying to be the best version of this that I can possibly be. And it's like contagious. So, I mean, that's a through line from a filmmaking standpoint with all the stuff I make. You know, for the delicacy, you know, I followed fishermen around, and not once did they say, if I can just catch enough of this, then I can be a dancer. Right. They just go, I'm going to be the best damn fisherman that could possibly exist. And I care about the environment, and I'm going to live here forever. So I don't want people to mistreat the land. I don't want people to mistreat the people. And then you start like going, oh, that's what a community is. I get it. And so that's what, you know, and that's what story comes from. So,
yeah. Well, yeah. I think I speak for Lou, and we, all of your movies, and obviously we geek out on I geek out on Somme TV. We're just, everything's so inspiring, but also, you're bringing awareness to what you're saying, these professions and a different way of thinking about food and wine and the world and the community. And I think that's why we continue to geek out, and we're excited to see what else is coming from you in the next time. You mentioned Pairings, your new series on, so that's one for sure. You be ready to eat when you watch that.
I was going to say, they just needed to issue a government warning when you watch Somme TV.
Yes.
Because first of all, you're going to be drooling all over your pillow. Second of all, I get addicted. You just get drawn in, and it's so addicting. Yeah. You know, I've realized lately I don't have to go to Tuscany. I just watched the 3-part series on Tuscany, and I go, gah, I didn't have to get on a plane. I didn't have to hire a cab. I didn't have to. It was like I was there. I'm done. Sangiovese, here I can.
Poured
a big glass of Sangiovese, and it was like, ah.
Well, yeah. I think there's an element of, like, you know, look, I'm lucky that I got to be in those places and film that stuff, but there is definitely an element of to be able to, educate and entertain at the same time with this kind of stuff. It's like a dream job. I mean, it's honestly, I cannot believe I get to do this. I mean, I have a crazy good team. So understand, it's not even close to just me. There's many people who work on this stuff, but it is it's a very, very, very fun thing. I will say it is incredibly difficult not to overindulge while you make this, edit this, I mean, I find myself at 1 a.m, I'm editing, and it's like, which is the case right now because we're finishing several films. And it's like, yeah, I could have a glass or 8 of wine right now while I'm working, and you just have to be very, very careful. But
yeah. Know what that's like.
I'm sure you do.
Well, yeah. I think the cinematography of actually to how you show the food, I'm always sort of like captured in this awe moment of how you bring that as an artistry to how he captures the food and the wine and the pouring and the, anyway, you guys have to watch it to experience that. But I have a question about pairings, because I think I remember hearing on one of your, on a podcast you did at some point, that you kind of were, your skepticism about food and wine pairings, a little bit of like, I don't believe in food and wine pairings or something to that effect. Maybe it wasn't that strong, but so I was surprised. So what inspired coming out with a show called The Pairings?
Well, I sort of, you know, on podcasts, anybody who listens to the Somme TV pod knows that I have some hot takes, and I will say that, all of them are for a reason. I mean, do I think that, and am I not afraid to say that I think 95% of food and wine pairings and the guidelines you're supposed to follow are BS? Yeah, I do believe. Because I also believe, like, anybody who has had a Sancerre that's, like, really high acid with a hamburger or a cheeseburger goes great. You know, people are like, well, it should be, you know, this red wine with a little bit of chill or whatever they say. And it's just nonsense, because the minute you throw a pickle on that burger, it changes everything. And like, so like my opinion too is like, throw that all out the window, and a beer is probably the best thing with a burger because it can handle all of it. And so there's too many gray areas when it comes to what to drink or eat. And the problem is with traveling, the more you have, I mean, I could spend the next 30 minutes telling you why you could do a 40-course meal that could be literally anything with only sherries. I would tell you right now, you could totally do that. And you could throw away all the red wine, and you could throw away all the sake, and you could throw away all the stuff and the hipster teas and whatever you're going to try to do it with whatever course. And you could just do sherry. You just do, you know, different versions of different kinds of sherry. And that's the problem with traveling, is you taste these things that you had not had before, and you start realizing, you know, certain food from Thailand does not need to have anything to do with the food, whatever you would drink in Thailand with it, unless you wanted to, because that's a totally different experience. So I think it is, I do rail against food and wine pairing, but I'm also as guilty as they come, because, you know, half of my content has to do with food and wine pairing on Somme TV. So I'm totally full of it myself.
Oops.
But yeah. But I also, but the idea of it more is just to get people to think, what if, you know, what if I had lamb and I didn't put it with this big red? What if I tried Zinfandel at a different temperature and had it with something that's completely unexpected? But I'm not going for, you know, with food and wine pairing, I find that the perfect pairing is actually a bad thing. When it's perfect, the food and the wine disappear in your mouth. You know, there's no, like, conversation. It's like, I've had some cheeses, especially, like, there's, like, Batard Montrachet in Burgundy that equal perfectly with some Burgundian cheeses. And it's almost like nothing, it goes away. It becomes neutral. And that would be considered perfect because they don't conflict with each other at all. But the one problem you have is that's not a pairing. That's just a meeting. They're perfectly paired, I guess, if you're looking for stuff to just equal each other. But there are other things where it's like, if you've never had an olive with sherry, you know, a green olive with sherry, where you're like, the salt of this and the oxidation of this, they don't mesh perfectly, but yet what you get is something new. You get a different flavor that could never have been accomplished if you had them alone. Whereas that cheese was incredible, but the wine just sort of took away some salt, and that wine was incredible, but the salt and everything took away the acid. So it just kind of made it very soft and wonderful, and it was delightful. But was it worth the money I spent for it? No, I'll take the olives in Southern Spain with the sherry that has this very strange, like, up and down flavor that goes with it that becomes something completely different. And you can never have that taste again if you don't have those two things together. And so I'm kind of more with that. And so when you look at pairings, I very much wanted to traverse the whole space of, I mean, the premier episode's a 3-star Michelin restaurant up in Healdsburg called Single Thread, which is one of the world's greatest restaurants, full stop. You don't even have to, like, anyone who's eaten there knows. And it's got the accolades, but it's also got a mentality of a husband and wife behind it that is so forward thinking and so not what a lot of people think of with 3-star Michelin restaurants, where it's very regimented, and there's a lack of adaptation because it's really hard to adapt once you have 3 stars, and they just do some things very differently. And so we wanted to start with them and show the way their garden and everything plays into the way they do food. But their sommelier, he's a firecracker. Rusty Rosilla, who's their head guy, he is somebody who is trying almost to disrupt, you know, at that level of dining, the way you would think of what you're going to get. So you'll get sake with something you shouldn't. You'll get, you know, some kind of wine that seems like out of place. You'll get, and he is somebody who I think is like pushing the envelope. And so, but that's 3 star. And then the episode 2 goes to Rome at this place that's essentially a really high-end wine bar. I don't know if they'd like me saying that, but I'd call it a wine bar. And they serve traditional Roman food, which is borderline peasant food. Very simple. And so we cook stuff like in the first episode, they do like, dishes that have a mushroom that is from this prefect of Japan that is smoked in a certain way with this cherry wood and everything's so specific. And then you go to the Rome episode, and the second one, they go, that's cacio pepe. It has 3 ingredients, pepper, cheese, and pasta. But in the chaos of those 3 ingredients, there's like 5 people you'll meet in your life, if you're very lucky, who can cook proper cacio pepe. And you could spend your whole life with excellent chefs and still 5. That's how hard these dishes are to make. And so they make meatballs, wine and cheese, or meat and cheese plates, and cacio pepe. I mean, that's it. That's the cook in this whole episode. And so the idea with pairings is to take a look across the spectrum of the kind of interaction with food and beverage. And there's a little bit of spirituality and kind of like people's opinions and X and Y. But that was the idea with pairings, was to try to put it on a slightly chemistry, emotional level, and try not to dogmify the BS. And so, I mean, it's, but also too, you know, if anybody's done more to dogmify the BS in this business, it's me, and I take full responsibility for it. So the truth is, I, to your listeners, I know how I sound and I know who I am. So, but it is like, this show is meant to kind of be a counter to that. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
You guys drinking yet? Are we drinking?
Yes, it's time. Coffee, it's Monday at noon. Sure, why not?
It's interesting. We did a podcast with John Ash, and I'm going back to that, Meredith. You know how he's called the father of wine country cuisine. He's got kind of brought it up, and he and Julia Childs taught at the CIA together, and you know their whole attitude and opinion on pairing wines was choose the wine that you want to drink that night, and pour yourself a glass while you're cooking, and make the food pair with that wine. So it supports what you're saying. And when you said the whole thing with pairing is BS, I agree wholeheartedly. You know, I think you drink what you want. Remember that, Meredith?
Yeah, no, I think that's true. My problem is if I start drinking while I'm cooking, I won't probably finish cooking.
If everyone else is drinking, you'll be okay. As long as you're not the only one, I suppose. Right.
But, and I'll admit, I'm kind of a nerd about pairings because I just love exploring. So it drives my husband crazy because I'll be planning a meal and then I'll be like overthinking it. Okay, we want to drink this bottle, and I'll go down the rabbit hole of what to eat. But at the end of the day, it is about just drinking what you like. I love to have that wow moment of like, wow, that really goes. I hate those where I feel like, and I remember John Ash, like, it's a train wreck. I don't want a train wreck. And I don't want like parallel train tracks. I just want that like wow moment of, wow, that goes really well together. So I guess you sometimes find that though by, to your point, not sticking with, you gotta just sometimes try things that may not work. You just go for it and see what happens and don't overthink it.
True. I really do think, just to like put a button on the food and wine pairing thing, is it's not thought about enough and overthought at the same time. That's the one problem, is the middle ground. I mean, my wife and I, there's a guarantee every meal we have, from a standpoint of at least dinner, is going to have wine. So it's going to have wine. We know that. There's going to be wine at the table. And so for the most part, what would go wrong terribly is if there was no wine. So we always start there. So it's like, there is wine.
Good point.
Do we know what we're going to eat? And oftentimes, you know, when you have little kids like I do, well, you know, do I want to cook 2 things, or do we just want to eat what the kids are going to be in the mood to eat? And I can tell you this right now. If you're having mac and cheese or grilled cheese or quesadillas and maybe you augment your version of that a little bit compared to theirs. But I can tell you, name me a wine that doesn't go with that stuff. I mean, just try. It doesn't. Like, so that's the problem is like, oh, all we have is this Cabernet. Or all we have is this, you know, $9 bottle of acidic Gruner Veltliner. All we have is X. We have bubbles or whatever. Guess what? They're all going to go great with any one of those foods. So it's like, how many people in the typical American household are having something for dinner where they're like, oh man, this bottle we happen to have is just not going to work. What are we going to do? It's just not, that just doesn't happen. That's my problem is like, people talk about this stuff like it's, you know, connecting neurons in the brain. And it's like, now neurons will fire if you do it right. Or maybe you go above and beyond. What my wife and I are really into is trying something we haven't had before. Now that's the exciting thing. Mm-hmm. So like if there's some wine that we just haven't had, and maybe that's just made from someone else. And in some cases, it's not even like it's that it's from a producer that maybe this is their first vintage and they just started. And we're like, mm-hmm. Oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, in a lot of cases, wine is wonderful, but wine augments. It's not the flowers at the center of the table. That's my wife. She's the reason I'm at the table. You know, it's not because the wine's there. So it's like, wine should augment stuff. And I kind of like, you know, and I think that she wouldn't be able to put up with me if there wasn't wine. So, you know, anyways.
Yeah,
I mean,
pour the wine, brother.
We could talk about this forever, but that's kind of my thoughts. And pairings came about to try to put real personalities into the conversation that wasn't competitive. You know, it was sort of philosophical. So hopefully it pans out.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to more of the episodes. I assume they're continue to be released. Okay.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Good.
Well, we'd love to know if there's anything you can tell us about that's in the works. I know that I saw a new Psalm film, Psalm 4 potentially. But you tell us what can you share with us?
I'm in a weird position with the Psalm franchise that I have two or three films that I'm trying to figure out if they could be branded under that name or if none should. It's very tricky. So I have three films. This is not a secret that are coming. Hey, let's do this. Let's talk about these. I don't know. You guys cut me off because you know I can talk. But we have one called Ghosts of Spring Mountain, which is a full-blown ghost story. I mean, I'm not kidding. This is a off-air. I'll send you guys the trailer if you don't share it. But it's we haven't premiered it yet. But it's basically a group of very, very, very important, smart women in the wine business take period Ouija boards that are about 120 years old into these abandoned wineries that are very abandoned and very fascinating. There's lots of trauma that happened in them. And let's just say that I will just say this. Ghosts come in a lot of forms. And this film sort of takes a look at the history of one particular part of Napa that has had a lot of trauma. And also, you know, we're talking about stuff that happened before Prohibition, which is like, might as well be the Jurassic period for American wine. Nobody knows it happened. Nobody knows anything about it. And honestly, if the film lives up to the editing I am seeing, it's scary as hell. And it's a documentary. So it's kind of like this very oddball thing that we kind of got together as a gimmick. And I think it worked better than we thought. I will say that.
Wow.
You know, Jason, there's a building here in Sonoma right next to La Casa that is haunted, officially haunted. Every time anybody's come in to try to redo it, it was an old hotel, they get run off. And there's there's a whole documentary film on spirits and ghosts in Sonoma. And it's pretty, you gotta find it, look at it. It's amazing the stuff that's happened.
Interesting. Well, I will say this, the there are more properties up in the Napa, Sonoma area. Like I said, ghosts come in different forms, but I would say that there are more properties up there that have trauma associated with them or tragedy and sat empty for a long time. And here's the thing. When something sits empty, the people who are near it, it takes on a life of its own. Meaning it's like you don't know what's going on. When something's not lived in, it becomes, you populate it yourself with things that must be inside. And there's a very interesting thing that happened in Napa, Sonoma, and some other areas up there, but really a lot up there, were these buildings that were built very magisterially, these huge, incredible buildings. They just sat empty for such a long time. And anyways, this film is very, very wild. It's bizarre, and it is like nothing I've ever seen in this kind of space. I watched 17 minutes of it with my 9-year-old daughter, and A, she was pretty afraid, and B, she was like, I really, really, really like this, Dad. And I was like, why do you like it? Because I like wanted to know, like, and she's like, because it's not about wine, really. I was like, uh-oh. I don't know if that's good, man.
Sick of the wine stuff, Dad.
For a 9-year-old, wine is probably not the most interesting thing, but she'll turn around.
I think I know where you're talking about. Jason, in Spring Mountain. I got several times. I've been taken way up in the back of the actual vineyard, Spring Mountain Winery. Yeah. And, you know, there's that abandoned winery, and they found bottles of wine in it. And then you keep going up. And what's weird to me is that house that sits on the very top of that mountain.
Yeah, there's so many. So that house, God, this is terrible. I'm just spoiling some things. But that house burned down during the glass fire, and we're the only ones who ever filmed it. Not just that, there's another winery called La Perla that is one of the first wineries built in California, and it burned down as well while we were filming. We were evacuated. I will just say this film is a wild movie, but there are three ghost wineries. Well, there are technically more, but three that we're working on in this story. So consider it like three chapters, and who haunts them and what it might be. And it is very, very, this is, I don't know. I don't know if it's a wine film, but it certainly has a lot of wine in it and around it. And it's a really, you know, I think it's the first time I've talked about the movie publicly, but it's like, it's a movie that I would consider a very fun hang. You know, if you see movies like Breakfast Club or something like that, where you're like, nothing really happened, but it was really fun to hang out with these people. And yet a lot happened when you start thinking about it. This is a movie like that in a very good way. And so I'll say that right now. Okay. I cannot wait until we're allowed to announce stuff. It is deeply in edit. There's lots, you know, this stuff is very exciting for me because it's like, whenever you get to push, you know, wine is not a genre, you know, I guess like in the overall thing, but like wine is a niche. And whenever you get to push that niche into other stuff and mess with pop culture and do all sorts of stuff like that, but yet make it so like, in a lot of cases I find like if I made films about race cars or wine or anything, you always have like a husband or a wife and one of them's really into it. And then the other person's 50% into it maybe, but it was this initiator, but I'm always chasing the film where the wife can take the husband and the husband can go, I just expected, you know, I was going to watch something she wanted me to watch. And here I am going, holy crap, this was awesome. And that's the high I am I'm chasing with these movies is that. So hopefully this is one of those. And then we have a film about the Judgment of Paris, very meticulously researched, which really has, I mean, I'm talking everybody top to bottom. I mean, we filmed quite a bit with Steven Spurrier before he passed away and quite a bit. I mean, every living person top to bottom on both sides of the pond is in this film. And it's the first time anyone's done anything like it. And also the Judgment of Paris is I think it's the most overblown event that's ever happened in wine. And yet people have highlighted the wrong stuff. You know, it's like post-Vietnam, America needed a win. There's a lot of things that were really cultural with this that are more important than wine. And so there's a really big story there, and that's in post-production. And then I have Cup of Salvation, which is my proverbial mea culpa on the whole wine situation. It's sort of the origin of wine and religion. And we were filming during a war in the Caucasus Mountains. That was something I wasn't expecting, and it was very harrowing. And then also, you know, we've filmed in the archives in the Vatican with stuff that's never been done. And then we filmed in a country that I'm not allowed to talk about right now that will be big news. So it's a wild, these three projects are ones that, you know, are at least, I can promise you one thing. They're going to be interesting. I don't know if you'll love them. I don't know if they'll be good. I never know these things, but I do think you'll go, how do they do this on a couple moments? So.
Yeah. Do you ever sleep? Do you ever?
I'm like a dolphin. I sleep with one eye open. Right now, it's always funny. Whenever I'm in edit, I host the SomTV podcast, and I get people reaching out, and they're like, "Wow, you're talking really fast on these pods." And I'm like, "Yeah, it's because I haven't slept in 5 days, and I'm living on coffee, and that's probably the way I'm talking now." It's I don't sleep very much, but also too, if I had, you know, doing these types of things and sleeping, it's tough for me to choose the sleeping, you know. This is really, it's really exciting stuff. It's a lot of fun. So
all three of these movies you've mentioned coming out, Lou, you and I are going to have to get our tickets.
I can't wait, man. This is crazy.
Back to, you know, the original question you have, a story and kind of motivation. It's like, the more you get entrenched in a niche or a world, and you guys know I love history, you start to just, it's never ending. And you kind of have to figure out what's worth your time because you only have so much of it. Mm-hmm. And oh my God, if I could clone, you know, Christina and Jackson and the rest of the team, it's astounding what's out there. It really is. Now you see why people are so obsessed with wine and food and travel, because it's just this amazing sinkhole. It's so wonderful.
Do the stories find you, or do you seek out the stories, or a little bit of both?
I don't know how to answer a question with a yes or no. I made a documentary at the very beginning of my career, which is still unreleased, about this is going to sound bonkers, but it'll give you a little peek into my brain, but also the documentary style, like of how you have to sort of be open. I was making a film about a snail that lives in one cave in Missouri, and it's the size of a grain of sand. And one man is trying to save it from extinction, but it has no purpose. It has no, it won't help anybody. It just happens to be an endemic species. I was obsessed with it. And I was trying to make a nature documentary, and I was ignoring the fact that this town is the most fascinating thing in the world. If I could go back and be that young man who started his first documentary, I would have expanded it to be like, you think it's a film about a snail, and yet it's a film about this town that is wildly interesting slice of Americana. And then it's a nature documentary about people kind of thing. And I think the biggest thing when you're trying to make non-scripted real documentaries, I'm not talking about like a series that's planned out with scripts. I'm talking about like you're following the story. Part of the reason a lot of my films, some included, it was hard to figure out when they were going to come is because I didn't sit down and script them. We didn't outline them. We said, look, here's what we have. I hope this happens. Can we guide anything? Probably not. And you just, that's why it takes 3 years to make these movies. And so I think the answer is both, but you have to have giant bat ears to listen, and you get a lot of forks, and some of those forks are really big. And you're like, if I take this fork, this movie's no longer about the person I thought it was. It's about a completely different person. And yet if I'm right, it's five times a better movie. And so it's really tricky. I mean, they feel like in the end they found me, but I'm not sure without the manipulation of me steering, or at least going down the right paths, it would go the other way, or my team, you know. But you have to have a very, very good gut. And if your gut's wrong, you got to be a good salesman to convince others that your gut wasn't. So it's a meandering answer, but it's a weird process, you know.
No, I'm with you. I think that's a good answer. This has been awesome. We've taken up a decent amount of your time, but we love hearing all the stories and all the projects that you have going. And you know, Lou and I'll be front row. I'll include David in that. David will be front row watching as well.
Well, I'll shoot you guys some trailers after this that you can watch and just keep them between us. But it's really, really an honor to be asked questions about this stuff, and also to be able to, you know, this is the exciting part of what I do. Not necessarily like promoting or talking about it, but sharing.
If our listeners want to get involved and see all the things that we've been talking about, take them through how to get on SOM TV and how it works. But again, there should be a government warning on this thing being addictive. So be careful, guys, when you start watching this.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's definitely some drugs in the water for sure.
Yeah.
I would say, you know, it's really easy. I mean, it's like, much like Netflix or anything like that, you know, you sign up online. You go to somtv.com and you sign up. This is the way that I think it's the easiest. You know, you create a username and password, and then you just sign into any device. So if you have an Apple TV or a Roku stick or a Roku TV or any of that stuff, an Amazon Fire, iPad, whatever, then you sign in with that, and you can just download the app and watch. And I find you know, whether you're doing dishes and you need something to keep you occupied, or you're sitting on the couch with your better half or something like that. I mean, it should be available everywhere, just like a Hulu or a Netflix. So, you know, and I obviously as a filmmaker, I would say watch it on your TV, but it does play really well on the phone as well. So
yeah, it does.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. That's how I did it. So guys, thank you, Meredith. Thank you. And
thanks, yeah. Jason. Thank you.
It's an honor. Thank you, Meredith. Thank you guys very much. Thank you, Lou. Thank you.